From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on October 3rd, 2013. A circuit court judge in Michigan sentenced former Major League Baseball player Chad Curtis to 7 to 15 years in prison after Curtis was convicted of molesting several teenage girls. Curtis's victims, 15 and 16 years old, spoke at the sentencing. They talked about how the former New York Yankee World Series hero broke their trust, fondling them in a windowless room when he was supposed to be tending to their sports injuries. This was a man revered by much of that Michigan community. Chad Curtis was never a great baseball player, but he played about 10 years in the big leagues. He hit a game-winning home run for the Yankees in the 99 World Series, also caught the final out of that series. And given his strenuously religious nature, Curtis fit in with that Michigan community that would become his post-baseball home. The teenage girls he was working with were largely religious too, and they respected him. Now, at the sentencing, the judge allowed Chad Curtis to speak, and he did, for almost a full hour. He blamed the victims and said that Jesus would forgive them for their lies. It was a classic scenario for sexual abuse victims. A trusted authority figure targets them, and the community is split on whether to believe them. It's why so many victims don't come forward immediately, if at all. Today, we're exploring the Chad Curtis story, and we're examining how it relates to so many other cases that we can learn from. Journalist Greg Hanlon sat down for 2 hours with Chad Curtis in prison for a story on the outstanding website called Sports on Earth. Hanlon changed the names of the victims and described how Curtis came to target them. Greg Hanlon's on the phone with us. Greg, excellent work on this, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks for having me.
In studio are two community leaders on this issue. Ed Suk is the executive director of the local chapter of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Ed, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Whittier is the executive director of the Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Mary, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
And before we kick it over to Greg for his perspective, I know Ed and Mary have read Greg's piece. Again, it's on Sports on Earth, and for our listeners, I've put a link on Twitter to it today. It's a long-form piece, but an important read, and I want to start with you, Mary. When you read Greg's piece, what'd you think?
Well, it's common in unfortunately in the area of child sexual abuse. 90% of children that are sexually abused are sexually abused by someone that they know, love, and trust. What's interesting is in the sports world, there's a fair amount, more and more now, you actually hear either athletes themselves coming out saying that they were victimized, and how difficult it was for them to talk about it because they revered the person that they worked with so closely. They revered their coach. In this situation, you've got someone who is in a position of power and authority that people revere as a baseball player, and he completely took advantage of those girls. It makes it so difficult for victims to come forward because the people molesting them are someone that they really care about, whether it's a coach, whether it's an advisor, whether it's a teacher, a grandmother, a grandfather, a stepdad, a cousin. It just makes it really difficult. And to also hear the community's response of many of them taking the side of the perpetrator is also disturbing but not surprising in a situation like this.
And we're going to talk later in this hour about the fact that there are things that sports leagues, parents can do that we can learn and maybe improve the communication and the resources available. And that's not to say that every league has abusers. In fact, the nice thing is that most coaches are great people, trainers are great people, but it does happen. Ed, you read Greg's piece. What did you think?
I thought it was extremely well done, very comprehensive, and I would agree with Mary, all too common from what we see on a regular basis when it comes to the victimization of kids. The other component to this whole situation is that there are very heavy religious overtones, not only the revered authority figure and a beloved coach and sports figure, but also someone who really seems to have taken the issue of religion and used it to his advantage in the grooming process with the kids. And I think that's especially disturbing in this situation. And we see, unfortunately, countless situations across the nation and internationally where individuals will cloak themselves in biblical verse so that when those observant eyes are looking at them, they quickly look away because they cannot believe that someone who holds such pious values could ever commit such a heinous crime against kids.
And as Greg has detailed in his piece for Sports on Earth, Chad Curtis was a player who went through six teams in 10 years, and I wouldn't say made enemies, but didn't make a whole lot of close friends because he was so pious in the clubhouse. Now, certainly some people respected him for that, other players. Greg, fair to say it was abrasive at times in his playing career?
Yeah, it's fair to say that he was a polarizing figure. And I think, you know, I mean, you say that he didn't make enemies. I don't know if he made sworn enemies, but it's fair to say that he, you know, he wasn't a teammate that, you know, a lot of guys like to play with.
Give a quick characterization of just how overtly religious he carried himself as a ball player, Greg.
Well, for instance, when guys would be watching Jerry Springer in the clubhouse before games, he would, you know, come over in front of the TV and turn it off and say, you know, this isn't good for you. In kind of a famous incident when he played with the Texas Rangers, one of the players on the team was playing a rap song, the Thong Song, which was popular in the early 2000s, and it's just sort of a goofy, you know, goofy rap song. And Chad Curtis and him, you know, kind of came to blows and almost got into a fight about it. So there are a number of these incidents where he, you know, I think one of the quotes in the story was, you know, he wanted to be a preacher, and that act gets old. And there were sort of a number of these, you know, incidents, too many to count to this effect.
And yet, until this trial came about, there wasn't a whole lot of question about how sincere he was, whether it was as a ball player or in his community life post-baseball. He went to a community where there was a lot of that sentiment. He was a very popular person for a number of reasons. And, Greg, you know, I'm a baseball fan. I knew Chad Curtis's name. I hadn't really followed where he had gone until your piece. So take us through why you wanted to pursue this jailhouse interview with Chad Curtis.
Yeah, I mean, to me, just the contrast between who he presented himself to be and what he did was just so compelling. And there was some news coverage of what happened to him, but just sort of the obligatory AP, you know, report about, you know, about the charges and kind of what happened. And there was more detailed coverage from the local press in Grand Rapids, but just the richness and the tragedy of this, you know, from everyone's perspective, of this, you know, great fall from, you know, this guy on top of the world with, you know, sort of purporting himself as this man of God to what happened, was just, you know, sort of so dramatic and so epic, and I wanted to kind of get into that in greater detail.
And you said in the piece that his attorney did not know about it and probably would not have allowed this interview?
Yeah, he sort of told me that with kind of a proud smirk, sort of indicating that he, you know, he was aware that not everyone agreed with him on everything, but that's not a new position for him. He kind of had this sort of, you know, a lot of his gestures kind of had this weary martyr aspect to him. You know, to them, that he was sort of this, you know, man alone kind of staking out this moral territory, and that if other people didn't understand or called him crazy, then that was something that he was used to.
We're talking
about sort of inoculated himself, you know, in his own mind, against, you know, people saying that he's deluded with the idea that it's nothing new.
Yeah, and we're going to get into more of what you took from that one-on-one interaction coming up here. We're talking to Greg Hanlon, who is a journalist who writes for, among others, Sports on Earth, an outstanding long-form journalism, and I guess that's the best way to describe it. I think it's better than Grantland. And Greg, for those who haven't read Sports on Earth, how would you describe it?
Sports on Earth is a comprehensive. I describe it as a website for the thinking fan.
Yeah.
And you know, there's sort of everything from analysis to, you know, kind of more sociological stuff and long form stuff. I'd say it's a website that prizes good writing and deep thinking about sports that often goes beyond who wins and who loses.
Yeah, and so we're talking about the Chad Curtis story and frankly the Chad Curtis tragedy, and he was on top of the world. He hit a walk-off home run for the Yankees in the 99 World Series. He caught the final out. When you see Yankees highlight reels of great World Series moments, you often see Chad Curtis's opposite field walk-off shot in there. And so even though he wasn't a great player throughout 10 years, he had some great moments, made a lot of money, a wife and six kids, and then goes on post-career. Greg, take us through how he eventually came into contact with these high school students. Where was he working and what was he doing?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he bounced around a lot during his career, and one reason people during his playing career, and one reason people speculate for why that is that he, you know, was something of an insufferable presence to his teammates. And similarly, after he retired, he embarked on a teaching career. His father had been a teacher, which was one of his motivations. Obviously, knowing what we know now, there were likely other motivations. But similarly to his playing career, his teaching career had many stops and many kind of short, contentious stints. So he got a teaching license at an evangelical university, and then had two kind of short stints that ended ingloriously at other local schools in the West Michigan area, which is where he grew up, and which, you know, kind of unbeknownst to me before reading or before reporting the story, is actually a very conservative, religious area. And then he wound up at Lakewood High School, which is in Lake Odessa, which is this sort of tiny community, maybe about 35, 40 minutes away from Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he was actually just a volunteer at the time. And he was a volunteer teacher and substitute teacher and weight room coordinator. And, you know, he kind of used that to sort of nudge his way in and ingratiate himself to a lot of students and a lot of faculty. And kind of, you know, before anyone knew it, he was kind of taking these young high school girls out of class and whisking them to this trainer's room, which, just the details are kind of chilling. It was this dark, windowless room that locked automatically. And he whisked them there under the guise of giving them athletic massages, which he was completely unqualified to do. I mean, he had no formal, you know, training as an athletic trainer or as a massage therapist. But his line to the girls, was that he had been at the highest levels of such things, and he had learned a thing or two in the big leagues. And, you know, in Lake Odessa, Michigan, the guy that had played for the Yankees, that credibility, as it were, went a long way.
And so the teachers, he'd pull these girls out of class, 15 years old, 16 years old, he'd pull them out of class, and the teachers would say what?
The teachers would say nothing. No one wanted to cross him. He was Chad Curtis. He was the big league ball player. And that is actually basically just after my story dropped, about a week after my story came out, three of the victims sued him and the district for $4 million. With the obvious thought of what in the world was the school doing? What in the world were these teachers doing?
Well, the story is called Sins of the Preacher on Sports on Earth, published on April 3rd by Greg Hanlon, and a long but compelling and important read. And so now we're getting a picture of how he set this up. And, what I'd like to do is I want to read a part of the piece here, Greg, and then we'll talk a little bit about this here, because we talk about sexual abuse. Unfortunately, it can mean many things. So I'm going to read directly from Greg's piece about how this was happening. After he took one of the girls down to the trainer's table, and again, as Greg described it, a windowless dark room that locked automatically, here's quoting from the piece. Quote, he laid her down on the trainer's table on her stomach and started with her hands. Relax, you're too tense, she testified that he said. Then he progressed to the shoulders. Then he removed her shirt, leaving her just a sports bra. I'm uncomfortable, but I don't say anything, the girl says, because in my head I'm going through all the talks that he had talked in class and how he was such a Christian guy. And so I was like, don't think there's something happening here that's not, you know, don't offend him. That was her testimony. It unfolded increment by increment. Curtis made small talk the whole time. First, he flipped her over on her back, exposing her front, and began massaging her stomach. Then, abruptly, he vaulted onto the table and was suddenly straddling her. And the girl testified, quote, once again, I tell myself, well, he's just trying to have a better angle at massaging my abdomen. She said Curtis asked her, are you sure you're okay with this? She didn't say no, so Curtis removed her sports bra and began massaging her bare breasts. Kayla stared at the ceiling, and again, Kayla is a pseudonym. Quote, I try to rationalize why he could think it was okay to do that, she testified. I was trying to figure out how it could better me as an athlete, because that was the idea for this massage, and I couldn't figure out, like, how that could make sense, and I wanted to say something, but I couldn't even open my mouth to say anything. End quote. I'm going to get back to Greg in a second. I'll start with you, Ed. When you hear the girl say, in her testimony, she didn't want to say no because she wanted to rationalize his molestation, and even when she felt it might be wrong, she couldn't say anything. There were people in that community during Chad Curtis's trial saying if she were telling the truth, she wouldn't have allowed that to happen. What do you say, Ed?
Well, I say this is a really classic example that we see every day in the work that we do in trying to protect kids and trying to hold offenders accountable for the crimes against kids. Kids find it incredibly difficult to share these experiences. They often feel guilty for being in the situation in the first place. And it can take months and years for kids to come forward and disclose their victimization. What I always find fascinating is when the first child in this type of a situation comes forward and makes a disclosure,
yep.
You then often start to see other children coming forward making similar disclosures. And the reason they come forward is because they finally feel empowered by victim number one, who finally comes forward and makes a statement. We see this all the time. It is incredibly difficult for children to challenge authority figures, especially beloved authority figures that have such high regard in a community. And when that is further complicated by religiosity as part of the whole grooming process, it really makes it very understandable for why a child would not come forward rapidly and share the details of what she experienced.
Mary, again, based on Greg's story there and based on her testimony, she was actually searching in her own mind to rationalize it, and she didn't want to offend him.
Right, because she cares about him at some level. You know, it's interesting. A lot of victims will say, I really, really care about him or her, or insert dad, stepdad, yeah. Grandpa, uncle, coach so-and-so, the religious leader, whomever it is. I really like them. I just wish they'd stop doing this. I really like them. I just don't want them to touch me anymore. And then, as Ed said, there's a lot of shame and guilt and blame that are many reasons why kids don't tell. And oftentimes the perpetrator, the offender, the predator, whatever word you want to use, weaves it and twists it where they are at fault. They fear, they put on the kid, you're at fault. The story reads on, when he kind of goes to sort of apologize, we shouldn't have done that. We takes zero responsibility for himself on what I did was completely wrong, and I am fully at fault. This man is so arrogant, he takes no responsibility for what he did and makes it really about himself and very, very manipulative. A lot of times we see this, and kids, as Ed said, sometimes when one child tells, it not only empowers them, but they realize they're not the only ones. So they realize I'm not alone. We saw that in Jerry Sandusky case and in this situation. And I just think that it's so difficult for a child to put their neck out there. We need to be thinking about why would they do this? There is substantial research to support in 92% of the cases where the child makes a disclosure of sexual abuse. The child, not the mom, not the dad, not somebody else. Where the child makes a disclosure, there is evidence to prove that to be true. 92% of the time. If your kid came home one day and said, someone stole my bike, it was in the back, I know, Dad, I should have locked it up, but it's gone and someone stole it, you wouldn't, you're lying, you're making it up, you just broke it on the way to school. Why do we go to, oh, could never happen? Because people don't want to wrap their heads around the fact that adults and older children oftentimes will do this to kids and molest children. And they don't want to believe that sexual abuse is as prevalent as it is when 1 in 10 children, by the time they turn 18, will suffer some form of sexual abuse. Yet less than 1 in 10 will disclose as a child, as Ed was referring to earlier, because it's so difficult.
Well, and that's exactly what Greg was describing here. So, Greg, we see that incident, and then we see, in my view, just reading your piece, it just was a similar MO for Chad Curtis to target these girls. And Mary kind of hinted at it, Greg. What happened when a girl finally essentially said no, you know, essentially said stop? Mary talked about the fact that Chad Curtis wanted to lay the blame on both of them and not himself.
Yeah, well, you know, when the accuser came forward, ultimately, I mean, she was completely ostracized by her classmates, by the whole school. Since the lawsuit has, you know, kind of news of the lawsuit is broken, you know, I've been seeing a lot of comments from, you know, people that went to school with these girls, and, you know, they said everyone was just completely against them, and immediately they became, you know, persona non grata, you know, at their schools. It invites the obvious question, which is, like, you know, this is so not the kind of attention that high school girls, like, want to draw to themselves.
That's right.
And, you know, I mean, a lot of the defenders of Curtis after this, their line was, oh, like, they just want attention. They just, you know, they want this and that. They're angry with him. Like, seeing what's happened to these girls' lives have been completely turned upside down by this whole thing. And it's nothing that anybody would want. And it's quite sad. One of the girls, you know, kind of, she is still, or at least one of the girls is still very shaken up psychologically. And her father actually testified that she still has trouble sleeping at night and that she'll crawl into bed, you know, with her mother, you know, nights on end because she has trouble sleeping. And just, you know, the profound effects it's had on these girls, it's quite sad.
And there's more motivation oftentimes for kids not to tell because they don't want, they fear the repercussion than it is to tell. So, you know, I think that we as a society need to listen to our children more on lots of different things. And this is just one of them.
If our listeners want to join the conversation, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Greg, Chad Curtis apparently wanted to pray with one of the girls after she kind of stopped him, kind of further inculcating this religious persona and this bond, huh?
Exactly, and reclaiming some sort of moral, you know, moral upper hand. You know, him as the teacher, him as the man of God, and it also enabled him to say to the girl when she asked him, you know, still sort of looking for answers from him. She asked him what he was going to do about it, and he said that he's going to keep it between himself and God.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Oh, no pun intended.
Man, Mary is shaking her head over there. You know, but it's amazing, but, you know, it probably allowed him to carry on with this longer than he would have. But the girls came forward. How many girls in all during the trial, Greg?
So there were three girls whose claims were actionable who were, you know, who he was prosecuted for, but there were five girls total, and two of the girls, you know, whose claims didn't get charges pressed, testified, you know, just as a pattern of behavior.
Ed, would you be surprised if there were more?
I would not be surprised if there were more. In fact, it's quite common when you see these kind of repeat serial molesters that there will be many more than one victim. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there would be more that would come forward. And again, if you realize how difficult it is for these kids to come forward, and kids are speaking with each other. So, you know, if there's a dozen victims and they're watching how the first three, four, or five are being treated and ostracized within their own community, who's going to come forward? I mean, it's that much more difficult for those kids to come forward. And as Mary was saying, in many of these situations, you know, kids are very attuned to their own communities and their own environments. And it doesn't take it much for them to realize if they come forward with an allegation against such a beloved figure that they may be the one that's ostracized. And in those situations, and this is, I find incredibly tragic, because in those situations, it's almost easier to continue to endure the abuse than it is to endure right, being a social outcast in your own school or in your own family or in your own community.
We're going to take the shortest break in radio, come right back with Mary Whittier and Ed Suk from Bavona and from Missing Exploited Children. Greg Hanlon's on the line. He's the journalist who wrote the piece Sins of the Preacher about former Yankees World Series hero Chad Curtis, who has been convicted of sexual molestation. He sat down in prison with Curtis for 2 hours, and we're going to hear Greg's take on some of the personality traits that just make Chad Curtis an extreme but a sad, sad case when we look at sexual abuse. And what else can we learn from it? What resources are out there? It's all coming up next on Connections on this Thursday afternoon.
The American shopping mall as we know it is dying. So, what do you suppose the new one's like?
Now it's where people walk their dogs and they're out with their kids and they're hanging out. It's an extension of their backyard.
I'm telling you, it really was. I'm Kai Rizdahl, the mall of the future, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
You can tune in to Marketplace tonight at 6:30 from member-supported WXXI AM, your NPR news station. You're listening to Connections with Evan Dawson on WXXI AM.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Historic House Parts, salvaging nostalgia since 1980, offering architectural salvage and restoration supplies, including vintage hardware, plumbing, and lighting. Located in the South Wedge at 540 South Avenue.
And welcome back to Connections on this Thursday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson, talking about Greg Hanlon's outstanding piece on sportsonearth.com called Sins of the Preacher. Mary was just saying during the break, Greg, and I want Mary's characterization, you were not surprised that Chad Curtis, sitting in prison, would not tell his attorney and would invite a journalist like Greg in, were you?
Absolutely, because it feeds his ego. A lot of offenders like this, they are egomaniacs. They're very narcissistic. It is all about them. And to have someone pay attention because I'm going to tell you my real story. I'm going to get my – meanwhile, he's so – I can't say what he's full of, but you know, very common too, the arrogance, and because he's revered in the baseball world, that I'm going to have a journalist write about me and publish it. I'm not going to tell my attorney because this is my chance to tell my side of the story.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that Chad Curtis has said he thought he was wrongfully represented during the trial because he was told not to testify, and if only he would have had a chance to take the stand, the truth would have come out here. Greg sat down for 2 hours in prison with Chad, and Greg, before we even got there, the judge gave Chad Curtis, as the judge does, a chance to speak at sentencing, and he spoke for how long? What happened?
Yeah, he spoke for 55 minutes, during which time he kind of became out of breath and lightheaded, and he actually asked the judge for a glass of water so he could kind of collect himself and start again. And this speech was, you know, was kind of embarrassing. It was kind of the culmination of this whole, you know, tragic, sad episode.
What did the prosecutor say about that speech?
She said that it was the most deluded, self-serving, victim-blaming, you know, speech she had ever heard in her entire career as a prosecutor.
And if our listeners are wondering, why would a judge let Chad Curtis speak for 55 minutes? Why don't you cut him off? I've spoke to people in the legal system, and there is a very big concern in sensitive cases like this that, you know, you don't want to do anything that will allow someone who's been convicted to appeal based on any kind of an improper handling. And so the judge often feels like, well, I've got to give you your time. So he had 55 minutes. He goes off to prison. And when you got – how did you get the interview to begin with, Greg? How did you approach it?
I mean, I was surprised. I was surprised that he granted it. I basically just approached the public relations staff of the prison and asked, and he accepted. And, you know, we set up a time, and I went out there and, you know, and met him, and it was sort of that simple.
Greg's take on that next, but let's get Jane in the city. Jane, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead.
Yes. My stepfather was a pedophile, in my opinion. I only know what I experienced and what my sisters told me about their experiences. But I knew very early on that this was not a grown man. He was just not a grown-up, sexually very immature in his whole attitude. And he was one of those people who constructed a mask. He would be the Santa Claus at Christmas. He would participate in the Halloween activities for children on Halloween. He was the family man, you know. And so I was the oldest, and he only molested me once. And my theory is that from then on he left me alone, and I can only think of my having been, as I still am, a talker. And I may have told my mother something and asked questions. I was a person that asked a lot of questions. And that may have ended it with me, but my younger sisters, he just went right on through, I believe, and based on what they told me. But here's the thing. I had one and still have one sister who basically thinks he was the most wonderful person and misinterpreted the sexual attention as real love. And you will not talk her out of that. And there's one thing I think we get caught up in is trying to judge, well, he was such a good... No, a lot of these things are calculated veneers to fool people and to get close to children. I had a therapist ask me one time, you know, there are men who look for women divorced with children, pretty children, and that's really why they marry them, that to get at the children. But if we get hung up on, is he a good man, is he partly good, bad, we're out of it. All we have to deal with is, did he commit a destructive and criminal act? If he did, that's the main thing. But I think we get, oh, well, he did all these nice things. Yeah. But anyway, thank you very
much. Thanks, Jane. What do you think, Ed?
I think the caller put it very eloquently. In these kind of situations, we see time and time again that the offenders are highly manipulative, and they purposefully put themselves in situations where they're going to have access and opportunity to have contact with kids. They have to have contact with their victims. So we see them gravitate towards these jobs where they're coaches or where they're priests or where they're volunteers and youth groups and so on. And it really puts them in a position not only of authority and high regard, but it puts them in direct access to kids. And we really do need to separate out the fact that they're a beloved figure and separate that out from the fact that they are potentially victimizing a child. And that's the biggest challenge I think we have as professionals and also in the general public, is to accept even the possibility that a beloved figure, a trusted adult, could potentially victimize a child. And we don't want to believe that.
Ed Suk is the executive director of the local chapter of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Mary Whittier is the executive director of the Bavona Child Advocacy Center. And Greg Hanlon, on the line with us, is the journalist and the author of the piece Sins of the Preacher, about Chad Curtis and the story of what led to Chad's prison sentence. 7 to 15 years for molesting 3 girls. There apparently were 5 that came forward. There could be more. And Greg, when you met him in prison, what were you expecting and what did you see?
I don't know what I was expecting. What sort of came across like most saliently to me was sort of how comfortable he was in this role as a martyr and like a victim, and of someone who, you know, has the weight on the world on his shoulders and who is misunderstood. It seemed to suit, you know, really seemed to suit him and kind of dovetail with the way that he, you know, as my reporting kind of brought out, the way that he liked to carry himself throughout his whole career is this kind of lone wolf who, you know, might be misunderstood, but he knows the deal and he, you know, he's doing the right thing where other people might not be.
He compared himself to Jesus?
Sort of indirectly. He was cognizant, and he was very smart in a way, and he was cognizant of me, you know, taking and running what he said, so he sort of always tried to preempt that by saying, and you might take this the wrong way, but, you know, and then he'd say something kind of, you know, grandiose and ridiculous. But he, what did he say? He said, you know, something about how the harsh judgments, you know, of human beings, you know, how Jesus led the perfect life and it got him crucified. Was his line. So it was sort of implicit that, you know, now I'm in prison.
me too, anything. Jesus. Yeah, right. One of those. Who, he said he wanted to write a book with one of his victims?
Yeah, and that was the kind of culmination of the 55-minute speech where he said that, you know, him and his victim would sit down one day and once she, you know, came forward and admitted that she had made up all these horrible things about him, that they would sit down and write a book together, which is just so kind of deluded and uncomfortable too, because it again kind of cast him in the role of as this mentor.
Yeah,
and I think too for the victim, I mean, that is so psychologically damaging to, you know, be patronizing and, you know, we know it's your fault. Kayla is one of the pseudonyms, but that he is the victim, that, you know, one day you'll see the light, one day you'll come to terms, one day you'll make it up to God and tell the truth. That is constant manipulation still, which is why for all victims of child sexual abuse, it is so important to have a support network around, certainly a professional and a therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, but also to have people surrounding that child that support and believe them. You know, we talk with our therapists at Bavona all the time, and a lot of times they'll say, just as important as getting a professional that works in this field is to have the non-offending family members believe and support that child. That is so therapeutic, because oftentimes if they're not believed and supported by the ones they care about most, that's where you see a lot of long-term psychological damage, and it's really a shame. And it's we've had similar situations and cases locally with what Jane was talking about earlier. Well, he's such a nice guy. And professional people where the community was divided. And we had a recent situation with a school teacher, and there was division around that. So I think that people don't realize, and of course, he doesn't care. He really doesn't care about these kids. He really doesn't. He cares about himself. And he doesn't care what kind of psychological damage he's doing. But statements like that are very, very harmful to kids, which is why they need the professional support and the support of people that do really care about them to be there long term.
Let's get back to the phones. Mike in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I'm concerned that this is such a sensitive issue, and there's people have such a visceral reaction to it that it's almost like lynching in the South during the Jim Crow era. Once the accusation is made, it's almost like it doesn't go away. And I'm thinking of a Bernie Fine in the shadow of the Sandusky case. They just became media events. And I think in the case of Bernie Fine that there might be some he might win a slander suit over this.
All right, but hold on a sec, Mike, because we are going to talk about an important point here. You raise an important point. Mary Whittier was on this program last month talking about a new initiative that is designed to make sure the adults who feel like you do, who say, you know, I don't know if there's an abuse case here and I don't want to ruin somebody's life. We're going to talk about that in a second. But do you think in this case, this is just from what you're hearing, you think that Chad Curtis got a raw deal?
I'm not familiar with the Curtis case. I came in and just heard that the topic was abuse. I heard the conversation about the pedophile, so I just said, well, can you really talk about the topic without considering what happened with the Penn State? Penn State is the only time there's been college riots in over 10 years, and it was over this case. So I just think there's an emotional connection that has to be related in these topics.
Well, he talked about Bernie Fine from Syracuse, and I don't know if our in-studio guests feel at all prepared to talk about that. He's talking about a case, Mike, saying, look, once the snowball starts downhill, whether he did it or not, the world thinks that you did. What do you think, Ed?
Well, certainly when you have an accusation of a public figure like that, there's a group of individuals that are going to immediately believe it, whether it's true or whether it's not. And I think what my experience has been is that the vast majority are going to struggle to get to the point of actually believing
it. Yeah, isn't there a group of people because of their star status who immediately don't believe it?
Many more so that will not believe it than will actually believe it. But it's certainly a risk. And, you know, I think that's the important thing to realize that, our community, let's say, we'll use Rochester as a very good example. I mean, we've got a wonderful organization here. Called the Bavona Child Advocacy Center, which brings together an amazing multidisciplinary team of professionals that do very thorough and appropriate, forensically trained investigations. And their goal is to come to the truth, to find out exactly what has happened. If we enter these situations being fearful of raising the possibility that a child's allegation may be accurate, then we doom these kids to continued victimization for in eternity. And we can't do that. We need to be able to have a vehicle out there that allows people to share the fact that they have a suspicion about something and then know that it's going to be investigated properly. What happened in in the Chad Curtis situation. He went through a very thorough judicial process and was found guilty.
Yeah, and for if you're just picking up the conversation as Mike was, Chad Curtis was a baseball star for the New York Yankees and some other teams, a World Series star, then went on to a post-baseball career, bounced around from different school districts, ended up doing some coaching, volunteering, was not really authorized to do athletic training and massage, did it anyway, pulled 15-year-old girls out of class, took them to a windowless basement room that author Greg Hanlon described as kind of like a dungeon, right, Greg? Is that...
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a really kind of chilling, creepy detail.
Yeah, automatically locking, and then removed their clothes and fondled them inappropriately, and these girls had respected him and finally eventually started coming forward, even though they risked friendships, the community was split, some called them liars, told them to leave school. It was rough for them. Now, Mary Whittier, last month, we talked about the fact that you've worked with the Ad Council. Mm-hmm. They've looked into the fact that for adults that witness actual abuse, more than 9 out of 10, but not 10 out of 10, still report it. I mean, we're talking about actually physically seeing with their eyes abuse. I don't know who wouldn't, but at least more than 9 out of 10 do. But for adults who suspect abuse, only about 3 out of 10 report, right?
And Evan, it's important to say, and Ed knows this because he's been in the field for a very long time, is that most child sexual abuse is not witnessed.
Right.
That's the, you know, you get a prosecutor in here, and it's the word of the child against the word of the adult or offender. And so that is so rare. It's also very rare for children to have physical findings in cases of child sexual abuse. So what we did with the Ad Council is there was some research done locally, and people were concerned about and thought they had to have proof positive. I have to witness it. I have to know it for sure. What if I ruin someone's life? That's a huge
allegation. What if they lose their job? All that stuff.
All that. And you know what? That's a big weight on your shoulder.
Absolutely.
So what we did was, as opposed to calling 911 or Child Protective Services hotline, which people were hesitant to do because they weren't really sure, they wanted some guidance and counsel. So we established the Be Brave helpline with the Ad Council, 1-844-BE-BRAVE, for folks to say, okay, I have this thing in my gut. I just can't. I'm concerned. I'm not really sure what to do. And they talk with a trained professional that will walk them through that process. Sometimes it's, you don't have to do anything. I hear what you're saying. There's not enough here to make a report. I think, you know, you're fine. Or, you know what, Mrs. Smith or Mr. Jones, there is, what you're telling me is very concerning, and I am going to connect you with the folks either at Bavona Child Advocacy Center, the state hotline, the local hotline, because people just want to get some answers and resources and test their gut. And we tell people all the time, do not ignore that. We would rather have you call and vet something out, and maybe it's nothing, rather than blowing it off, and then you find out something happened to a child, and now you've got guilt around, holy cow, I could have done something maybe to protect that child.
And to Mike's point, our caller's point, if you make the call, that does not guarantee that person's life is going to be ruined.
Absolutely
if they didn't do it, that doesn't guarantee that they're going to lose a job. That guarantees that someone will look into it in an appropriate fashion, and if nothing happened, then there's a very, very high likelihood that everybody moves on.
And I think it's a step even before that. So if Mike calls and says, I've got this concern about my neighbor, not really sure, the person on the other end is going to ask some questions and do an assessment. And it may be that, you know what, I don't think there's not enough here to make a formal report. There's not, you know, thank you for calling, but these are some resources, or give options and alternatives. So it could be that. It could be that they really don't have to take any more action.
Yeah.
And then it could also be, you know what, there is enough here to get the authorities involved, and thank you so much. Within 24 hours of that hotline going up, we got a horrendous, horrendous call that is now being investigated, that is, we believe preliminarily that child sexual abuse is going on.
Okay. Now, one more time. That number is?
1-844-BE-BRAVE.
Before I get back to Greg Hanlon and ask him for some wrap-up thoughts on his outstanding piece called Sins of the Preacher, which I've linked to on Twitter at Evan Dawson that we've been talking about here. Ed, I know there's a couple of other initiatives that people should know about. There's Take 25. There's also some movement to get more. I think if my son's going to be in Little League eventually, the different leagues. You want parents to be able to feel confident. So first of all, Take 25 is what?
Take 25 is an initiative that we engage every April, May, and the beginning of June, and it encourages parents to take 25 minutes to talk to their kids about child safety. And you can begin by talking about safety in your home, about safety riding your bicycle, and so on, and then move into the areas of safety from potential predators. And we try to make it very easy. We're very focused on education as a way to empower children to be safer and to empower parents to do a better job in protecting kids from victimization. So Take 25, it's a wonderful website, very easy to use, conversation starters, safety tips for different ages, safety online, safety in the real world, safety to and from school, some basic usable skills that you can utilize as a parent or any adult to talk to any children in your life about safety and to do it in a short amount of time.
The website again is?
Take25.org.
And when it comes to Little League, what do you want to see happen? What's going on that will allow parents to feel better about it? I mean, and again, I'm not afraid to let my kid play sports, but I would feel an extra step could be taken to make us all feel like, okay, anything ever happens, we're going to be okay here.
Absolutely. Sporting organizations, youth groups, we want to trust the fact that they have gone, that individuals involved, coaches, volunteers have gone through a thorough background check, that there's policies and procedures in place to protect our kids, especially when you have like travel leagues and so on. So we pulled together a group of 50 top organizational leaders last year, brought them to our headquarters office, did a major a conference called Safe to Compete. And if you go to safetocompete.org, you can actually watch every one of the presentations that took place. It's still existing on our website. And the whole goal was to organize and put together policies and best practices for those youth sports organizations to implement so that kids could be safer when they're in youth sports. And I'll give you this as a really good example. You know, as a parent, if I'm going to go and I'm going to be oriented to a baseball, a little league sport for my child, I would love to hear a coach and a volunteer and someone from the organization tell me that if my child is bullied or if anything inappropriate happens or if there are any concerns that my child has, tell me who I can go to. If they already have that policy in place, it should be very easy for them to say, hey, if this happens, talk to Coach Jim Johnson.
Yep.
Talk to the board president, Mike Baker, whoever it happens to be. But as a parent, that would be very empowering for me. And it also opens my eyes that I should talk to my children about this as well.
And that website is?
Safetocompete.org.
All right, Greg, let's wrap up with this. Got about a minute left here. Your piece has sparked this conversation. You've got more people talking about making sure kids are protected. And we don't do it in a fear-mongering way. The great news is most coaches are great people. And that's a great thing.
Absolutely.
But Greg, give me a quick snapshot of some of the other feedback you've gotten, whether it's from that community. I don't know if you've heard from Chad Curtis himself or others since the piece came out.
Yeah, no, I actually have not heard from Chad Curtis, although I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if I did. The feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I think for everyone, there's something kind of cathartic about bringing this stuff out into the open and into the light. In the same way, actually, as Ed just kind of brought up about how empowering it is if a coach says, you know, there are these resources in place, like, you know, just to know, like, this is out there. I think, you know, just discussing this stuff openly is helpful, and that's sort of the nature of the response I've gotten back, and it's been very rewarding.
Greg Hanlon, congratulations on a great piece there, and we look forward to more of your work on Sports on Earth and others. Where would you like us to follow your work?
You can follow me at Greg Hanlon. That's my Twitter account, so follow me there.
Thanks for taking the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, and Ed, Mary, always great to see you, and thanks for pushing the conversation forward with us today, too.
Evan, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having us.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, come back. New UN report on climate change. What do we have to do by 2050? Is it realistic? The Sierra Club weighs in next.